case for argument this morning is Lapka against Chertoff.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning, Your Honor. Robert Whitfield for the plaintiff, Leah Lapka. Ms. Lapka brought this case under two different statutes, Title VII, which she alleged sexual harassment based on the actions of a coworker, and also she alleged retaliation under Title VII. She also sued under the Privacy Act, alleging that she was denied access to her records, and more specifically, she was seeking those records which would have given her information about the status of the investigation into the incident which happened at a federal training center in Brunswick, Georgia. She alleged she was raped by a coworker while attending this training session. The district court granted summary judgment, and in its decision stated, among other things, that there was no reasonable that a reasonable jury could not conclude that the agency had not done everything that could be done to prevent harassment by the individual who Ms. Lapka had accused, Paul Garcia. The district court cited some cases, which I just want to briefly mention. I believe it's the Weininger case, which says that in employer and co-worker liability cases, the employer, if they fail to take action or force the victim to bear the cost of solving the problem, then there could be liability. And that's important because the district court says that there's no evidence that something could be done. The pleading, the answers to the complaint themselves, provide a basis that contradicts that entirely. One of the things the court says is it's undisputed that once she complained, they immediately issued a memorandum restricting visitation. That is not true. And the pleadings and the answers to the complaint show that that's not true. She complained in an email dated June 12, 2003, to her supervisor, her immediate supervisor, asking what could be done after Jamie Garcia, the brother of Paul Garcia, who was accused of the rape, visited for 40 minutes. He was not on official business. He was apparently visiting friends. The supervisor's response that same day, and this is they admit this in their answer to paragraph 86, was that she could not penalize Jamie Garcia for something the brother did, which is a strange answer since I'm assuming any employer has the right to tell an employee who doesn't work there that you can't lauder here on your off day. Nevertheless, nothing else was done. On August 22nd, Paul Garcia visited the office for 45 minutes. Again, he was not on duty. He was visiting friends. She was not there, but she was told about it, became extremely upset, wrote an email that very day asking what could be done about this. This was very upsetting and so forth. She was already seeing, having psychiatric help over this incident. She heard nothing about it. She confronted her supervisor 5 days later on August 27th, wanted to know what could be done about these visits, could anything be done to stop them. Her supervisor responded in a very telling email, and again, this is all in their answer to the complaint, which they admit, as Exhibit 13. The email from her immediate supervisor said, "I will see if it would be possible to get the message to Paul through his supervisor that he is not to visit our office. I will also let all employees know through a memorandum that all visitors must be escorted. I do not see a reason for Paul to be here." Now, this is the supervisor who suggested this remedy. However, she didn't follow through. Nothing was done, no contact with the supervisor, nothing at all, no memorandum. On September 3rd, having heard nothing, the plaintiff sent another email to her supervisors referencing her other email saying, "Has anything been done? Since nothing has been done," she had contacted Federal Protective Service, which provides security for all the federal buildings, including this one. And she had talked to the area commander, who said he could keep Paul Garcia out of the building. All he needed was for the management and supervisors to tell him, and he would do that. She sent that email, and this is admitted again. This is at Exhibit 13 of the complaint. They admit that she sent that email. No response, no action whatsoever. On September 8th, since she hadn't heard anything, she sent another email saying since she hadn't heard anything, now she took it upon herself to get a protective order in state court, which she did, and said she would send a copy, and again asked had anything been done about her previous emails about contacting a supervisor. Only then, September 12th, 4 days later, did they finally issue a memorandum, and it was just a general memorandum saying visitors must be escorted. This man, Paul Garcia, at the time was a law enforcement official with badges. He could enter the building at any time whatsoever. Maybe he would not have been able to enter her office area, although we see later that, in fact, he and his brother could. But he could enter the building at any time and confront her either when she went to the washroom or to the lunchroom or when she was coming and entering the building. What the general memorandum did not do, it did not follow through on the supervisor's own suggestion some 2 weeks earlier that she would contact a supervisor. Nothing was done in that respect, and nothing was done as far as contacting Federal Protective Service, which all they had to do was do so, and he would have been banned from the building. He did not work there. He had no official business there.
But he also wasn't there trying to see her, either the brother or Paul Garcia, and no effort was made to contact her, to see her, to speak with her. They just happened to be in the building. On what theory could that possibly be sexual harassment when it was just a happenstance visit to the same building?
Well, she had complained and accused this person of rape, and he had faced a criminal investigation in Georgia at the time.
I understand that, but it's my understanding that you're not arguing that that is actionable because there was certainly no foreseeability there. There was nothing that had happened
preceding
that.
And that is true. We're not.
So that's not, the rape is not actionable. It's not part of the claim, as I understand your argument, or is it?
No, we're not saying that the rape is actionable.
So you're arguing that the two visits by the brother, or maybe it was three.
Three visits by the brother
to the same building, but not any. There was no effort made by him to contact her, to see her, to speak with her, to even be in the same room as her, as I understand it.
Well,
and then the one visit by the assailant on a day when she wasn't even there, and again, no evidence that he was there to speak with her, to visit her, to try to have any contact with her whatsoever. It was just a happenstance visit to somebody else in the building. How does that amount to harassment, setting aside whether the agency's reaction was reasonable?
Well, first of all, the visits by the brother, he was intercepted when some of her coworkers saw him, and it was they who escorted him out before he could get to the point of trying to contact
him. But there isn't any evidence suggesting that any of his visits to the building were to see her or to talk to her or to make any contact with her whatsoever.
There's no evidence that that was the case.
Right, so how can that constitute sexual harassment?
Well, because we look at the Weininger case, which says that an employer's response to allegations of employee harassment must be reasonably calculated to prevent harassment based upon the particular facts and circumstances of the case.
Right, you got to have harassment in the first place.
But where a person alleges they have been raped by a person and that person comes unannounced to the office, a jury certainly could reasonably infer that that would cause this person undue stress and anxiety. And in fact, she was under psychiatric care for almost 2 years and still is at this point. So, you know, our contention is that fact that should have gone to the jury. Were visits by these people sufficient to harass somebody? And remember, it's not only that he had raped her, she had accused him of a criminal act, which he could have been, you know, had he been charged, he obviously could have faced imprisonment or something else and loss of his job. So was it reasonable for her to feel upset over someone visiting, especially since it was not official business? And the reasonable steps that could have been taken were not going to cause the agency any kind of, in this particular fact, all they had to do was tell, you can't come in the building. You have no business here. You want to visit your friends, do a lunchtime or so forth. That's very reasonable. It's not expensive. It wasn't anything undue that they had to do.
So it's your position that the agency should have anticipated these unannounced visits to the building?
No, not anticipated, but once she complained that these visits were, which she did in writing and verbally, were unnerving and unsettling and disrupting her ability to work.
Well, then, at that point, the agency did take some action.
She complained in June 12th. They did nothing until, as I just made out this timeline, until September 12th when they issued a general memorandum and didn't even follow their own suggestion, which the supervisor had made, saying, I will contact the supervisor. She never did. Did not follow the plaintiff's thing, which she contacted Federal Protective Service and said, we'll keep him out of the building. All management has to do is tell us that. They never did that. Two things that they could have done with no problem, no fuss, no added expense, and they didn't do. One of them their own suggestion. And I'll reserve time.
Thank you. Your time has expired. Mr. Kuhn. Mr. Whitfield, sit at council table.
May it please the court. The agency, when they responded to Ms. Lapka's concerns, acted promptly and appropriately and reasonably. Now, Mr. Whitfield is mixing apples and oranges. When we argued and the district court found that immediate action was taken, that was in response to her complaint that a coworker said that her assailant had been in the office. Now, 3 months or 2 months prior to that, his brother had been there, and she did voice complaints. And the response was, we can't penalize him. He didn't do anything. If anything happens, if he bothers you, he gets online, let us know. There was never any contact between Ms. Lapka and her assailant's brother. Never any problems. Now, after the assailant was seen there and she went to her supervisor had to wait for the district director to get back to issue the memorandum, which was issued immediately upon his return. In addition, the district director contacted Mr. Garcia's supervisor. Now, at this time, if you recall, the Department of Homeland Security split up INS, and Ms. Lapka worked for Citizenship and Immigration Services. Mr. Garcia worked for Customs and Border Protection, two separate agencies. But a district director contacted the chief inspector out at the airport and said, please do not send Mr. Garcia over here on any official business. And he never came back. The steps that the agency took were reasonable, and they worked. Ms. Lapka also, as far as the visits go, I think, you know, he hasn't, the evidence doesn't show there was anything else that we should have done or could have properly done. We can't just bar somebody from a public building because somebody in one agency is afraid that they may come there, and especially when nothing has happened. Her supervisors were aware of it, her coworkers were aware of it. There were no further incidents. She also claims that she was subject to retaliation based upon some minor job actions that were taken. She was assigned certain cases. She had been moved from one building to another. I would point out, first of all, none of these were even addressed in the district court level in their brief in response to summary judgment. Therefore, they have been waived. Additionally, they were not adverse actions, as this court has identified or defined what an adverse action is. And as the district court found, she has identified no similarly situated persons who were treated differently than she was. And they also raised the issue of, in their brief, but not here today, of the Privacy Act. And as we pointed out in our brief, the documents that were being sought were exempted from the Privacy Act and properly so as investigative records from an investigative agency. And based upon that, they were not produced. However, once this litigation commenced and an order from a court of competent jurisdiction was obtained.
The brief says that the documents were turned over in discovery with redactions. Was there any objection to the redactions during the discovery process?
None, Judge. There was an agreed protective order entered and an agreed order under the Privacy Act, and that they were turned over, and there was no objection whatsoever.
What was redacted?
Social Security numbers, addresses, but no information about the actual investigation, just personal information about
the name persons. Of the subject was certainly known. It wouldn't be affected by redaction.
There were no names for redacted judges, just personal information, address, social security numbers, and the like. If there are no other questions of me, I will just ask that the court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Okay, thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.